Hello, and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the AgThentic Group. I'm Sarah Nolette. We often hear how adoption of tech in ag is slow compared to other industries. But if you take a moment to think about autonomous farming, we've come a long way in even just the past 5 years. One group that's been helping to drive this is Hands Free Hector, which is now the Hands Free Farm. They began in the UK in 2016, setting out to become the first in the world to plant, tend, and then harvest a crop fully remotely using autonomous machines. At the time, many said it couldn't be done and that robots on farms were still 20 or even 50 years away. Kit Franklin has spearheaded the project, which is a collaboration between Precision Decisions and Harper Adams University, where Kit is also a senior lecturer in agricultural engineering. But it's his work outside the lecture halls that has garnered the most attention.
And we set a combine driving itself in the middle of a showground, combining barley. It's just madness. I don't know why we said yes, we'd do it. I don't know why. It's just, you know, looking back now, what a crazy thing to do. It'd be crazy enough to run a combine live at a show, let alone one without someone sat on it, and then include a load of 200 people leaning on a barrier trying to get the best shot on their camera phone, you know?
It's this willingness to do something crazy and show the world while you're doing it that has been the key to the project's success. Sure, now there are many startups and even some big ag machinery companies that are developing autonomous vehicles. But for Kit, it was never about bringing a specific product to market. It's been about generating ideas. And there's maybe a lesson in here for all of us about how shifting people's mindsets can be just as important as developing new technologies. To understand what Kit did and how, we have to go back to the beginning.
So I'm born and brought up on a UK farm, a small farm, essentially arable. My father diversified, as it were, and went into construction, essentially farmed on weekends. So that's the sort of scale we're talking about. It's not a major thing. Although my brothers then did go into agriculture in a major way and created a contracting business. So my background is both in agricultural contracting and construction contracting. So lots of machines, tractors, diggers, dumpers, all of those things were my sort of childhood and hence my interest in engineering, which is what my profession is, obviously.
Do you find that having a bit of that farming background is helpful in what you're doing now? Like just having grown up in it a little bit or grown up around it, does that have either an influence or kind of help you with credibility in having some of these conversations with the industry?
Yeah, it's absolutely essential. Now, I say that in the sense that I find it essential, but that's not to say that someone who doesn't have that background shouldn't enter this industry. I want to see a diverse range of people coming into ag tech and ag engineering. I want new, fresh ideas. But yeah, in terms of where I sit, it means that I can communicate with farmers. I can communicate with the customer base essentially a lot better. You know, it's that whole thing. It's the world, because I've been immersed in it all my life. You know all the lingo that you don't even realize isn't normal language and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, just having an awareness of the problem. So, I've said before, if you are coming into ag engineering, ag tech from a non-ag background, I would always encourage people to go and work on a farm. Even if it's a day, you know, go and help a farmer out. You'll soon learn the difficulties that farming faces, and you'll soon find problems that need solving. And ultimately, engineers are problem solvers, and farms are full of problems.
Growing up, Kit was more interested in the farm machinery than the actual farming. So he went on to study engineering at Harper Adams University.
Really, it was all about big, shiny machines, and that was what interested me. However, Harper Adams is a specialist agricultural rural economy type university. And through studying here, I was taught by and also met fellow students who were pure, straight agricultural people. And through the time of being here and essentially going to the pub and drinking with these people and chatting away and going to lectures, I actually became more interested in farming. So I'd grown up on a farm, but my interest was farm machines. It wasn't farming. But by the time I graduated, I had sort of developed a love of actually farming itself. What came to mind is that I wanted to not just be an engineer in an office drawing things. I wanted to solve farmers' problems. That, you know, I can't change farming by developing a new crop because I'm not a biologist, but I can develop farming by changing the machinery or looking at that a bit differently. And essentially, I sort of learned to be quite skeptical about the way in which UK farms, Western Europe farms were being farmed. I came to believe that we're using too big machines that are too heavy, aren't very precise, and we could be farming with more appropriate machines than we currently are. So that was what got my interest in sort of ag tech. Could we use things other than chemicals to control weeds? That's not to say that I'm completely anti-chemicals, but could we use other tech or a combination of chemical and mechanical technologies? Could we use automation to reduce the scale of our machines? All these sorts of ideas and were going through my head when I was coming up to graduate, which basically meant I decided I didn't really just want to go and design another big heavy tractor for a company. I wanted to go and do weird different things.
I love it. Falling into different careers. That makes sense. And then how did the idea for Hands Free Hector come about? Were you just, you know, sitting at the pub where all good agricultural ideas are hatched and thought, you know, what if we do this crazy project? Or how did it come to be?
I mean, yeah, the story goes the idea came out of the pub. It wasn't quite like that. I was working as a mechanic. I was doing the mechanical bits, and I was working with a colleague called Jonathan Gill, who was doing the electronics control bits, and he's got a background in robotics engineering. And basically, we were working under a chap by the name of Professor Simon Blackmore, who was one of the sort of leading lights in agricultural robotic concepts and ideas, and had been writing about it for 15, 20 years at that time already. So we were surrounded by these ideas of farming with robots and the benefits that that could bring. But Jonathan and I were very frustrated that no one seemed to be getting on and doing it. We were doing some quite clever stuff, but most of it was under non-disclosure agreements and we couldn't talk about it. So I would go to a show, for instance, and I would talk about on a show stand or on a stage at a show, I would give a talk about the concept of agricultural robotics. And the crowd reaction would be, don't believe it, too far-fetched, where's the proof, where I've not seen it, I've not done it. So basically, Jonathan and I felt like we could do it. You know, everyone's saying it can't be done because otherwise it would have been done. And we were saying, well, it can be done, we just haven't done it yet. So basically, Jonathan and I decided he was developing drones, so flying machines, and his flying machines would come out of the box, they'd, you know, fly around the air, dot point to point, land back at his feet. So we said, well, could we just take the brain out of John's drones, put it in a tractor, do farming, show that we could farm with robots, move this story that had got very stagnant. You know, there was lots of ideas, but no one really doing it. Yeah, show the world that it was possible, not wrap it up under non-disclosure agreements, basically. The word, the phrase hands-free hectare that was, I guess, critical in what gave us the publicity that we've ended up getting came out of a sort of 15-minute chat after lunch one day. And the story goes, we wrote it on a post-it note and we stuck it on the wall, hands-free hectare. It was quite a big post-it note and we wrote it quite big, and it was in our lab, and all our superiors came in and out for about 6 months. No one asked us what the words hands-free hectare meant. And then eventually we managed to sort of put together a funding bid to make it happen, really.
The team received funding from Innovate UK, a government innovation agency, and also got Precision Decisions, a precision ag services company, on board. While the project itself was never about creating a commercial product, it had the potential to unlock solutions to problems that might eventually be commercialized. Things like freeing up time normally spent on a tractor for other work, reducing soil compaction with small machines, unlocking precision applications to reduce chemical inputs, and making small farms more profitable by growing more from less or changing the economics.
So it was a feasibility study, and really it was about doing exactly what we were setting out to do, showing if it was possible, and if it was possible, about sparking another load of ideas. We always knew we'd create more questions than answers, and that's certainly proven to be the case. And I think that's what Innovate quite liked, is that ultimately we were going to probably stir up a load of new ideas within the UK, you know. And we said we were going to be really public, put it all on social media, invite journalists around, invite camera crews around. So again, they probably liked the fact that we were going to showcase UK and this UK innovation and what small teams on small budgets can achieve if they're focused. I mean, that was all the sales pitch, was all of those things. And then it's gone on to be all of that 10 times what we could have ever imagined, you know. So this story has gone, you know, 90 odd countries have published stories on it. I've been on most major broadcasters in sort of North America, obviously Europe have played clips of our project. It's been absolutely like mad, and ultimately it was about generating interest in ideas, and I think it achieved that. It was never at the end of a year we're going to have a product that's going to make 10 million a year turnover or something. That was never going to happen. It was much more about idea generation.
And how about feedback from farmers? What have you heard and what's the response been from the farming community?
Your action was immensely positive. This whole perception that farmers are backwards, they don't want to know, they don't want to change, I find mostly completely wrong. It's a very small minority. I do get it. I do get farmers who go, I think you're talking rubbish. It's never going to happen. It's just nice videos. But it's a very small minority. Most think it's really great. And going back to my thing about standing on show stands and giving a speech or whatever, the reaction I used to get is not in my lifetime, not till 2050, not for 30, 50 years. Now, after hands-free, that instantly changed. I'd go show a video, talk about it, and they'd be like, oh, so what do you reckon, the next decade or so? You know, so it really changed that perception. Did exactly what I hoped it would do. You know, it showed people, by showing we could do it, it changed the mindset of all those people who've seen it. And then, and in the bigger context, I mean, it's very easy to try and take all the credit for everything that's happened in automation for ag in the last 5 years, but I won't try and do that. But genuinely, when we, in 2016, I could not point to an agricultural robot or an agricultural robotics project that got beyond a car park. That was our pitch. We are going to go beyond a car park. We're going to grow crops. We were the first to do it in terms of getting all the way through that growth cycle. And then since then, I can now point to tens of examples of companies and projects where they are growing crops with robots and where robots are on sale and whatever. So I'm not saying I caused all that, but we were the perfect time. We generated this huge amount of interest. And since then, there's been a big follow-up from the commercial world, from universities around the world as well, who've sort of followed in that wake of publicity and appetite, I think, from farmers. Because, yeah, the appetite suddenly came that, when can I buy this? When can I buy this? Well, again, 2017, I was still going, oh, well, not yet. Now, when someone says, when can I buy it? I say, well, go and talk to one of these companies because I think they might be able to help you.
Yeah, right. Do you, like, obviously one of the pushbacks there is, well, you guys did it, but it was at a pretty small scale. And obviously there's lots of kind of asterisks and caveats and that kind of thing. How do you, like, what happened next? Because obviously that was the next step in expanding it. But also, how do you respond to that question around, like, well, proving it's possible in a controlled environment with a university setting and a couple hundred K, you know, that's pretty different than revolutionizing farming in kind of commercial practice.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And in fact, I just didn't touch on that. But yeah. So I get, this is brilliant. But then I'd also get, it is a square flat field. My fields aren't square and flat, and they're certainly bigger than 1 hectare. So we do get that. But I still, even the people who are saying that are mostly being positive. They're not, they're just going, how do I see it in my farm sort of thing. So yeah, it made us want to do it better. But if you look back to our very first videos, our first field of crop looked pretty rubbish. No one would be proud of it. The only people who were proud of it were the people who just made a robot do it. We were very proud of it, but it was all full of misses. You know, the tractor drove like a snake up the field. The combine was pretty good, actually, by the time we got to harvest, but it wasn't great. So we instantly rolled it over again, and we got another sort of smaller dose of funding to eventually do it again and make it better. And in the second year, we had far better coverage and the tractor drove far better, and et cetera, et cetera. So that was one thing we could do to instantly go, look, yeah, we had a single year and a single little bit of money and a pretty small team. There's only really three of us working on it, and that's what we achieved. But look, after another year, we've already made it this much better. And now since then, we've gone on to now have what we call the hands-free farm, which is now 35 hectares. It's 5 fields. They're sort of average UK field sizes. So we've got one that's 2 hectares, pretty small. We've got one that's sort of 15 hectares, which is, you know, reasonable for the UK. It's not, you know, they're not the biggest fields you'll find here, but they're fairly representative of UK fields. And they're not square, they're not completely flat, they're not the most banked, but there is topography in them. They're certainly not square in shape, though. They've got wonky headlands, we've got trees and telegraph poles, we've got power lines, you know, we've got footpaths. So big issue in UK ag, or big issue for UK autonomous ag, is we have footpaths everywhere. So people can take their dog for a walk through the middle of our fields or around the edges of our fields. And, you know, how do we deal with that? I know that Australia, they've just released the code of practice for Australian autonomous farm vehicles, which, you know, we've had good, really good contact, pretty positive contact with those guys. But there's very little in that document that is about the public, because, you know, farm setting in Australia, not much public. For us, that's our biggest concern. You know, I think there's a massive section on wildfires. Well, that's less of a concern for the UK, where it rains all the time. But the point is, we've now scaled it up. We've got real fields that are real weird shapes and sizes. And now we're continuing to show this. So whenever we're in the field, there'll be a live video or, you know, on Twitter. Or to be honest, just because the research has got so much more tricky, it's been harder to keep the social media going. When we had 1 hectare, the jobs took a couple of hours and then you were done. So you could do lots of YouTube and tweets to tell the world. Now we've got 35 hectares, that will take so much more time. It's harder to keep on top of making sure we've got a YouTube video up and making sure we've got a tweet out and whatever. But we do try our best to keep people in the loop, show people the bad as well as the good. I mean, I did a Facebook live video once. I was watching the sprayer go across the field and it just completely went off at an angle. And I kept it live. You know, I was like, well, you know, the whole point is we're showing that this isn't easy, that we're having problems. So yeah, I mean, it's getting to the point now that a UK farmer can come and see our fields and go, yeah, this is representative of what I work with on a daily basis. So yeah, I mean, just funny story. We demonstrated a robotic combine at Cereals, which is the, you know, one of the UK's biggest agricultural shows. So in the middle of a show, they grew us a plot of barley. So we had a sort of 20 meter by 20 meter plot of barley in the middle of a show with a fence around it. And we set a combine driving itself in the middle of a showground, combining barley. I mean, it's just madness. I don't know why we said yes, we'd do it. I don't know why. It's just, you know, looking back now, what a crazy thing to do. It'd be crazy enough to run a combine live at a show, let alone one without someone sat on it, and then include a load of, you know, 200 people leaning on a barrier trying to get the best shot on their camera phone, you know? So we've done some pretty crazy stuff to try and communicate what we do and try and build that appetite for what we do.
It's really interesting, the balance there. Like, it really resonates what you're saying about doing the work versus showing it off and starting those conversations. But you really have to do both, because there's, especially in ag, right? There's so many people that just get on with doing the work and then no one hears about it. And then there's sort of this frustration when it's like, oh, but we're already doing that. We're way ahead, but we're not talking about it. And yet it is really hard to balance and find the time to have those conversations and make it accessible and edit the video and have the tweet. Like, it's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it scares me every day that someone's going to come out and go, oh, you know, you've been spending the last 5 years claiming you're the world's first people to grow an entire cropping cycle autonomously. Well, actually, we did it before. We just never told anyone. As yet, no one's come out and said it. Yeah. It's that fact that I know for certain there are certain people who are a long way ahead of us at certain points of what we do, but maybe aren't telling the world for whatever reason. A lot of the bigger companies, it's not currently right for them to commercially advertise what they're doing, you know, ultimately. Whereas if you're the smaller startup or you're the, you know, the disruptor, it makes a lot of sense to be making a lot of noise.
I want to come back to that point actually around the big guys, but tell me about the tech stack. Like, what have you guys had to build versus buy?
Essentially, with the original system, we based that around open source drone technology, the stuff that was making multi-rotors fly. So we took the control board, which was got various, you know, GPS chip, IMUs, etc., essentially a mobile, essentially the guts of a smartphone, running open source software, Mission Planner, if anyone wants to have a go, PixHawk controllers, if you want to have a go, if you can still get them, they might not even exist anymore, I don't know. So we basically took that off-the-shelf stuff that anybody could buy for a couple of hundred quid, and then we integrated that through motor controllers, etc., into a hydrostatic tractor of around 40 horsepower, an Iseki tractor. The tractor was all mechanical, so there's no fly-by-wire on it, so it's like literally a foot pedal to make it go forwards and backwards. So we put a linear actuator on that foot pedal and pushed and pulled the foot pedal. We had a motor on the steering column to turn the steering column. So it was all quite, I guess, sort of rudimentary. And that was all part of it as well. It doesn't have to be complicated, you know, because again, that's a massive barrier that people use to automation, is they go, oh, but it needs to be so complicated. We need SLAM and we need radars and we need this. No, you don't. No, you don't. If you're Elon Musk and Tesla, yeah, you might need all that stuff and you've got loads of money. But actually, you most of the time, you don't need that stuff. Most of the time, there are simple solutions to these things. So we did it pretty simply. obviously it's all GPS based, as you know, absolutely critical. It's got RTK based GPS. We used a prototype system we got from China that was really cheap. Again, just to show that we could do it without spending, you know, because everyone goes, oh, RTK system, £5,000-6,000. Well, no, we did it with a £1,500 RTK system, actually. You know, it doesn't have to be loads of money. So that was what original hands-free was, plus some safety on top. So we had laser scanner on the front and we had safety stop buttons. Now, since then, we've now teamed up with a further company. So we still work with Precision Decisions, who are now owned by a bigger company called Map of Ag, who some of your listeners may have heard of. They're a New Zealand-based company. But now we also work with a company called FarmScan Ag. Now, FarmScan Ag have Australian origins, and they have been making, you know, control systems for sprayers and seeders and GPS systems for years. And they are working with us to develop a more sort of proprietary retrofit autonomous system. But it's kind of the same thing. We call it the Beam now. So rather than a Pixhawk controller, we now have a thing we call the Beam, which is a metal box full of wizardry. And that goes on the top of the cab. And then we take the signals from that. And as Harper Adams, we integrate that with the tractor. Now, we have now three different tractors, three different levels of complexity. We still have our first one, which is all mechanical levers and links. But we also have two others that have more electronics on them. So CAN system. So we're taking those signals and now we just send a CAN signal to the transmission to go faster, slower. We now send a electronic signal to a hydraulic block to turn the wheels left or right, you know. So it's all kind of progressed a little bit. And the aim is, you know, now in terms of, again, you asked earlier, what are the commercial outcomes? Well, hands-free was all about ideas. A hands-free hectare was all about ideas. Hands-free farm is now about getting towards commercialization. So that product, FarmScan, here in the UK, are developing what they hope will be a retrofit product that you can go and buy from them to fit on your tractor. You know, that's the aim. But again, still all GPS based with limited sort of safety from lasers, radars, that sort of stuff.
And when you did Hands Back There, you were saying you were kind of looking out at the world and feeling like you guys were really ahead of where things were in beyond the concept videos and the parking lot demos. When you look out now and you see all those companies out there and probably some of the R&D labs of the big guys, do you still feel like what you're doing is cutting edge, or how do you, or is it, you know, answering more academic questions or more raising awareness again? How do you kind of see the landscape?
I don't know. I think it's quite easy to sometimes see, you know, still a promo video come out from one of the new startups that shows a really flash dashboard software package that they instantly create a route map around the field. And you go, oh God, we're still behind that. Ours is still taking us an hour to create a route map. And then you go, but remember, it's still a marketing video. So I think we're probably there or thereabouts with most people around the world and what they're doing. But we are different in the sense that our partners are trying to do commercial things. So PD is part of Map of Ag, are trying to do the dashboarding, the sort of remote monitoring, generating route plans, that stuff. You've got FarmScan trying to make a really robust on-tractor system and trying to build relationships with other companies to do the safety side of that onboard system. And obviously you're still trying to do this outreach, you know, again, still trying to show the world what we're doing. And we try and actively build up all the other people. If you look at me on Twitter, you know, I spend my life retweeting all these other companies that are doing cool stuff because I've been talking about it for years. And those people who did say I was talking rubbish, it's nice now that I can go, nah, here's another one to look at. Here's another one to look at.
So what has Kit learned about the future of autonomous farming? Will companies be more successful in focusing on retrofit solutions, or will it be companies building new autonomous machinery that succeed? And will this be done by startups or the big machinery companies?
So for me, we made sure our farm looked like a farm because of our trying to tell a story thing. I didn't want a machine that didn't look like a tractor doing farming because I wanted it to be relatable and digestible to farmers, you know? I didn't want it to look like a spaceship had landed in our field to do some farming. Now, there are people making spaceships to go farming who are believers that it's going to be some sort of revolution and the tractors will all be burnt and their spaceships will take over. I normally call them hoovers, actually. I normally say they look like hoovers, vacuum cleaners. I personally think it will be a sort of evolution rather than a revolution. And that's the reason that I think that the stuff we're doing with retrofit has its place, that people will go, so I've got a tractor. I still quite like the idea of being able to drive it myself between places, maybe, you know, doing just a quick job. But actually, if I'm going to stick it in a field to drive up and down in straight lines for 10 hours to turn a field brown, I quite like the idea of it driving itself with a retrofit system on it. And then maybe once they've done that for 2 or 3 years, yeah, maybe they'll start questioning, well, actually, I don't even want to do the small jobs either. Maybe I do want a thing that's purely a robot. So I think there's a place for retrofit. The same as, I mean, the same as auto steer. You know, at first, auto steer was a retrofit market. Now the retrofit market's completely died because it comes out of factory standard. And I just see the same as that happening for us, is that at first it'll be retrofit and individual and weird and novel. And then as time goes on, it will mature into a situation where you buy dedicated autonomous machines. And those machines may look like vacuum cleaners or whatever, spaceships or whatever, you know. But I wanted our tractors to look like tractors.
Yeah, fair enough. I like the vacuum cleaner example. We've definitely seen a few of those. Do you see there's sort of two, I guess, other dimensions here. One is robots that do specific tasks. So I'm building a spraying robot. I'm building a, you know, spreading robot or whatever it might be, versus the more kind of utility platform approach. What's your view on how the world will evolve there?
Yeah, so you just use the word utility platform. What you're saying there is the word tractor, aren't you? Because what a tractor is it's a moving thing that powers and pulls other things, and they are interchangeable. And the amount of times, yeah, I read people going, oh no, this is a brand new robotic system that's got adaptable and integratable with different parts. Okay, so it's a tractor then, isn't it? What you've developed there is a tractor. It doesn't look like a tractor, but you've developed a new type of tractor, haven't you? So again, this is where I come from, an ag background. I find a lot of these startups, and I get quite cynical about some of the wording. It's like, another one that gets me, this is just because I'm on a rant now. Another one that gets me is farming as a service. So always reading about farming as a service. Now, yeah, great. In Silicon Valley, something as a service is a sexy term, yeah? So using as a service gets you investment in Silicon Valley. But I'm a farmer, so farming as a service is called, in the UK, is called contracting. It's existed for the last 100 years. It came, you know, my grandfather used to have a threshing box and used to go around all the farms in our area threshing everyone's grain in 1930. You know, farming as a service is called contracting, and it's existed forever. So stop trying to tell me that you're reinventing a wheel. You're not reinventing. And the same is the said for the, so back to your actual question. Yes, there will be robots that will be developed to do niche weird things. This is a purely weeding robot. There will also be robots that can have different implements to do different jobs, but I would call that a tractor.
I think that's true. I mean, we just wrote an article called How Silicon Valley Killed Ag Tech. So I can join you on this rant as I sit here in Silicon Valley recording this podcast. But it is this interesting confluence of these two worlds. And to your point in the beginning, these new perspectives that are coming in, maybe you have worked at Tesla, or maybe you have worked, like, we absolutely need those perspectives, but they need to be grounded in how farming actually works.
Yes. If you say, I'm going to come and contract for you with a robot, he'll go, okay, I'm interested, you know, because instantly you're talking the right language.
Absolutely. What have you learned, Kit, about so we've talked a little bit about how equipment will change or not change in some cases. How about how the whole kind of system needs to change? You know, there's a bunch of angles there, kind of new jobs and education, non-chemical approaches, given what robots can do, sort of standards and robot interactions with humans, insurance. Like, what's most exciting to you about how the whole system starts to change when we have autonomy?
I think one big aim for me, being an educator, as it were, is there's a big aim that people stop seeing agriculture as backwards and something that only, to be really blunt, only idiots would do farming. Oh, you got, if you're not very clever, go and do some farming, you know, which is still the attitude when I was at school here in the UK. It was definitely the, you know, I had friends who just wanted to be farmers, and that was like, wow, you are pretty stupid, so carry on, sort of thing. Or, you know, so what I want to see is we get away from that, because no, actually, to be a farmer is to, well, and those, again, those who farm know this all along. Being a farmer is being a businessman. It's being a vet. It's being a this, it's being a that, you know, it's a million things. Being an engineer is being a mechanic. But again, what I think will make the wider world realize is go, look, no, farming is being a robotics engineer. No, let's be even more blunt. People who I currently lecture as undergrad students came to Harper Adams because they saw my project and thought it was interesting. So people who wouldn't have come into my industry are sat in my lectures now because of my project. So that encapsulates what I'm trying to achieve here in terms of getting those new, fresh brains into this world. And I say, every fresh idea is good, but make sure it's rooted in ag. Rooted in ag.
Yeah. So, a few of those puns around in ag and ag tech, especially. You probably get asked too, and like, given the timing of when you've started this project and the questions or concerns from some groups around labor in agriculture and the role of autonomy, taking jobs, taking over, given where you sit in the UK, thinking about Brexit, you know, did that at all play into the kind of media and conversations that you've been having around this project?
Yeah, so my statement is that the work we're doing, which is very much arable agriculture, cereal crop production, etc., is we lost our labor 30, 40, 50 years ago. I have a graph that I open up at conferences with that shows the labor force on UK farms against the growth of population in the UK. And basically, 100 years ago, 5% of the UK population worked on farms. Now 1% does. So I'm not trying to cope with a lack of labor in the future. I'm trying to cope with a lack of labor now. And if I can take someone out of a tractor seat, driving in straight lines, you know, being rude for a second to those who do it. But if I can get you out of that tractor seat driving in straight lines, and I can get you in the office planning for next year, or in the field with a spade looking at your soils, that is a better use of your time. And that is what agricultural robotics for me in my industry, which is cereal crop production, is all about. It's about better utilizing the people we have, much less than it is about getting rid of those people. That is not a factor I'm playing into. Now, here in the UK, you mentioned Brexit. We do have an issue in the horticulture, fresh fruit, fresh food produce sector, because we have a lack of people coming into the country now to pick fruit, vegetables, whatever. So there is plenty of projects, plenty of research going on around, can we robotically pick strawberries? I mean, you probably spoke to people doing this sort of thing. And that is about plugging a labor gap, but that isn't my project, and that's not what I'm trying to do. Just to go into that, what I find interesting, again, here's my two pence on another thing, is that people in the world of agriculture robotics seem to want to solve the, I hate the word, but I can't ever think of anything better, the sort of sexy problems. So I want to pick strawberries because that'll be really jazzy. I'll make a really good funding begging bowl video if I can pick strawberries. Actually, do you know what? If you go on a fruit farm, 40% of the people are picking fruit. Then there's 20% that are doing logistics, moving fruit up and down polytunnels. And then there's 40% who are grading them in a shed somewhere. Well, do you know which are the easy bits to automate? Grading's really easy to automate. Moving stuff up and down polytunnels is easy to automate. Has anyone automated it yet? Not really, not widely. Stop trying to pick strawberries. Do the stuff that's easy first. You know, it drives me mad. You know, the amount of funding that's been thrown at picking a strawberry when actually just sorting out the logistics would be a much quicker labor saving if that's truly what you're trying to do. So yeah, I mean, for my project wasn't about that. It was about utilizing the human resource we have in a better way. Full stop.
Love it. And I guess last question along the lines of some of the other changes. You mentioned code of practice, kind of standards, insurance. What are you seeing change there? What have you guys learned about how, again, that kind of broader system needs to evolve?
Yeah, at the moment, there is no system. So we operate under autonomous trialing code of practice here in the UK. There is no legislative legal framework in which to operate an autonomous tractor machine in a field. So we are trying to develop that. That's probably the biggest, most important piece of work I am doing really at the moment, is we are working with the British Standards Institute to develop a UK code of practice for autonomous vehicle operations, very similar to the Australian one, but specific for our marketplace. And obviously that has buy-in from multiple manufacturers, farming groups. We have people like walking groups here in the UK. What do they want to see from an autonomous system to make them feel safe? So they're around the table. You know, we've got the health and safety exec. We've got a lot of people around the table discussing how do we use these machines in a way that is both profitable and safe, because we're very, very clear. If you look at our economics that we've done, if you require permanent on-site supervision, it kills the economics. The whole point is it's getting the person out of the field and back in the office or in another field with a spade or whatever, as I said earlier. And if you, our economic models are based around 10% human interaction. They don't actually change much if you put it up to 20% human interaction at the moment. So our models suggest we can cut the cost of wheat production by around £30 per ton in the UK, which is basically a profit margin or not, essentially. So it's really, really good to see. It makes smaller farms profitable, which is interesting from a UK landscape point of view. We've got a lot of farms that have had to amalgamate, or, you know, one person rents out to the other and then goes and gets a job or whatever. So our system can make a 100-hectare farm profitable in the UK from our modeling. At the moment, you need to be 500 hectares to be profitable growing wheat, you know. So that's a big change for our countryside, but it can only happen if we get a good framework in which to operate. So that's all the work, and all of that's only possible because I'm now, you know, for want of a better word, vaguely famous, you know. So when we speak to the insurance companies, they will talk to me because they go, oh, Christ, that's that chap who knows about robots. And we've seen him on telly and he's been in the magazines a few times. So they'll pick up the phone. You know, if we hadn't done hands-free, I wouldn't be able to be pushing those agendas. So those hands-free has enabled me to push those agendas on the behalf of the whole industry, I'd like to think.
That's probably a question you get asked all the time. I know it's when I get asked, like, there's all these startup companies building the vacuum cleaners and spaceships and new digital three-point linkage equivalents, et cetera. Why won't the big guys just do it? Do you get asked that, and how do you answer it?
Because it's massively disruptive to their marketplace. So the market has been, buy a new tractor, it's bigger and shinier than the one you had before. That is how big companies have sold stuff. And I very bluntly say that to them when I speak to them. You know, that is the market. If it's newer, shinier, got a bit more chrome, got a bit more horsepower, it will sell. What my world is suggesting is that, no, maybe it does need to always be bigger. Maybe it needs to be more precise, smaller, and more niche, more capable, not just bigger. And that is massively disruptive. And yeah, so why would you want to do it, in a sense? If you're making lots of money doing what you're doing, why would you want to do it? And all of those big companies could have done it 10, 12 years ago. They made a decision not to, is the way I like to look. You know, when they made tractors steer themselves, they could have very easily gone, right, let's make them autonomous in the next 5-10 years. Let's do it. But they all made the decision not to because they didn't need to, essentially. It wasn't a Now, though, with all the startups, with people like me being a thorn in the side, you start to see it coming out. So John Deere, denial knowledge of, or denial appetite for autonomous farming forever, until Agritechnica 2019, they have half a show stand dedicated to agricultural robots out of nowhere. You know, John Deere, not interested in agricultural robots. Oh, wait, today we are. You know, why was that? Now, again, that's one of the like things that I like to take a little bit of credit for, because it was people like myself and my team and others like us who basically pushed them into a corner where they couldn't not do it anymore. They had to go, oh, we're doing it too, you know. So, yeah, why the big guys aren't doing it right now is pretty much because of it's very disruptive.
But Kit doesn't see the future of farming as a job that can be performed entirely from inside an office, which, for the farmers listening, is probably a relief.
We obviously went under branding of hands-free. And so the hands-free hectare, just to put a finer point on, we never went in that field. You know, we did all the agronomy remotely. We had a fence around the field, only the machines. We basically drove the machines through the fence, got off the machine, walked out the field, off it went. The drones did the sampling, everything. We never went in the field. We never took a sample. Everything was done remotely. And then obviously the question was, so is that what you see the future of farming to be? And I always have to go, no, we're just trying to prove a point that it can be done. I think that kind of goes to show that if we can make the job more diverse, more whatever, then that's kind of a good thing. And of course, these machines aren't going to work 100% of the time. You still need that 10, 20% interaction where you're going to be setting them up, servicing them, whatever. It's a new set of skills. I want people to be out there touching things, you know, touching, smelling, digging. That's how you learn about your farm.
And that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Thank you for listening. And if you like what you hear, please tell a friend or leave us a review so others can find the show. It really helps us out. You can find more resources about hands-free hectare and the other topics we discussed on our website, agtechsowhat.com. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.